This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. That's when we check in with reporters in the Northwest Indiana media about the stories that they've posted online and they've put in print. And today we are checking in with our friend Dan Carton. He's the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Dan, as always, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, you had a number of interesting stories. Let's start out first, though, with some sad news here on a report that you put out here concerning however many Hoosier children had suffered some fatal abuse or neglect, and then how it turned out to be, I guess, an interesting budget item in the Pence administration.
Yeah. So every the state keeps track of suspicious child deaths, for potential prosecution and for other reasons. And after the State Department of Child Services and other groups investigate these suspicious deaths, trying to understand whether any of them stem from child abuse or neglect. It takes a while to investigate. So we just got the 2016 report that showed 59 Hoosier children died from abuse and neglect between July 2015 and June 2016. But that actually was down 23% from the 77 child abuse and neglect deaths that were recorded in the 2015 budget year. And one reason for the decline, it appears, is that in August 2015, Governor Holcomb at the time, or Governor Pence at the time, allocated some additional money to the Department of Child Services that they put into hiring more family case managers and trying to raise more awareness. So more family case managers to investigate reported child abuse claims, and then also just trying to make people more aware of child abuse and neglect. And that extra money corresponded to the decline in child abuse and neglect deaths in 2016. And then under Governor Holcomb, he's put even more money into DCS. So we should know probably next summer whether or not that has paid off in still more reduced child abuse and neglect death.
Does it seem that the abuse and neglect fatality rate dropping, and you said it was and corresponding at least to more funds coming into DCS when it was Governor Mike Pence in the State House, is there any correlation, or do we know yet, I guess, whether that have to do with some of the problems that there had been internally at the DCS?
Yeah, well, you have the same director, former Lake County Judge Mary Beth Bonaventura, was there in 2016, and then up until this January, when she was complaining about the parsimony of the Holcomb administration compared to the Pence administration. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if we see sort of a blip up in child abuse and neglect deaths in the coming years, in the coming years' reports from 2017, 2018. We'll know if she was right about that, or what effect the money actually has on how many children end up losing their lives.
Did the report have any specific information in there that talks about locations or anything like that that might mention, I guess, give some clue as to where some of the deaths due to abuse or neglect may have happened?
Yeah, it shows the counties where the deaths happened. There was one child abuse death in Lake County, one child neglect death in LaPorte County. And if you read the report, it's on the Times website, it actually goes through the pretty grim circumstances of each child death, sort of just to get it in the record of how that happened, and what opportunities were missed, and you know what the state might learn from that. But it's a problem all over the state, and you know the Times reports on it. You know, obviously it's a continuing problem. Governor Pence at the time attributed it to the surge in heroin abuse and other opioids, and you know while the state has been trying to do a lot to stop that, that hasn't completely abated yet. So you get these carry-on effects from drug abuse that unfortunately are ending up killing some Hoosier kids.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Dan Carton with the Times of Northwest Indiana. And one of the stories we've kind of followed, I know it started out even during the summer months here, we had a feature that came out of just south of us here, where a reporter went along with the Frankfurt mayor to check and see about the alarming problems that they have at railroad crossings, and in particular in the mayor's city down there in Frankfurt, about how trains would block crossings and trains would stop in crossings, and of course, cause a lot of traffic problems there. But now I understand that it's come about with, I guess, some resolution in a way, maybe not to the liking of the cities, from the Indiana Supreme Court. Tell us what was brought up before the Indiana Supreme Court and how the decision turned out.
Yeah, absolutely. Indiana has had a law on its books since 1865. So from the very beginning of train travel, that said if you block an intersection with a road, with a train, for more than 10 minutes, the local police can issue a fine to that train, and the train would get ticketed because, you know, obviously people need roads to get where they're going, and, you know, while the trains have the right-of-way on the tracks, the state has said, we don't want you blocking our roads. You know, the ambulances can't get through, kids are trying to get home from school. You know, there's all sorts of reasons that you don't want stopped trains all over the place. They upped the fine, the General Assembly upped the fine a few years ago to $200, which, you know, is a lot for, say, a traffic ticket, but if you're a multi-billion railroad company, it's a drop in the bucket. But Norfolk Southern got a bunch of tickets in the Fort Wayne area and decided to challenge the law, and they brought this case that ended up getting to the Indiana Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court determined that a 1995 federal law superseded the Indiana law. It was a federal policy deregulating the railroads.
Mm-hmm.
So it said that the states couldn't regulate how trains operated, and the Supreme Court determined that included ticketing them for blocking crossings, because they said that's telling the trains how they're operating, which is prohibited by the federal law. So the law is still on the books in Indiana, but police no longer can enforce it, that trains can't block intersections for longer than 10 minutes. So if you're waiting for a train to pass, you might be waiting for a long time in the near future.
Now, it was interesting. I know in your story, it's out there online as well as in print, in the ruling that was handed down from the state Supreme Court, that Chief Justice Loretta Rush, who is a native, at least as a child, of Lake County, had some interesting things to say in her opinion that's in the record.
Yeah. She wrote the ruling for the Supreme Court, and she really got into sort of the details of how the federal law said states can no longer manage or govern rail transportation. And she explained that even though states have this general police power to, you know, ensure road safety and railroad safety and intersection safety, the way she interpreted the law, she said that forcing trains to, you know, clear intersections within 10 minutes is in fact managing or governing rail transportation, because the law is essentially telling the railroad companies that they have to, you know, either drive their trains faster or run shorter trains, or there's another possibility where if the train had to stop for some reason, they could split the train to open an intersection. But that actually is extremely ineffective because it takes longer than 10 minutes to hook the train back up and do all the mandatory testing. So they're either going to get fined on the front end or the back end.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, the court and Chief Justice Rush concluded that the state is telling the train how it has to operate, which is not permitted under federal law.
Now, I understand, too, in the story that you also checked in with some of our Northwest Indiana communities that are most affected by slow trains or stopped trains, and of course, Hammond's one of them, with a lot of trains going through that community all the time. What did you find in your conversation with Mayor Tom McDermott Jr. about that?
Yeah, Mayor McDermott not especially happy with the outcome. You know, everybody knows Chicago is a massive train hub, but for all those trains to get to Chicago, they have to pass through Northwest Indiana. So you see all those tracks everywhere, and particularly in Hammond. And Mayor McDermott, you know, said that the long train waits are one of the things people complain about the most to him. And Hammond police have been trying to enforce the law. They, you know, they'll give tickets to trains whenever it's a possibility. But even the mayor acknowledged that it wasn't particularly effective because, like I said earlier, if you're a multi-billion-dollar company, a $200 ticket from some town in Indiana isn't going to make much of a difference in your business practices.
You have another story, too, that's out there to look at as well, too. We're talking about Chief Justice Loretta Rush, but you mentioned about the fact that she's picked up an interesting honor recently. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The Indiana Chamber of Commerce every year selects one state official, and they name that person their Government Leader of the Year. So for this year, Chief Justice Rush, who, as you pointed out, lived in Munster as a child, is going to receive the Indiana Chamber of Commerce Government Leader of the Year Award at the Chamber's Award Ceremony in November. It's a big honor. They were praising her for her work to get the court system more involved in combating drug abuse. The courts have done, you know, they have drug courts in a lot of counties now where instead of sending somebody who's using drugs to prison, they'll sort of connect them to intensive community services under the supervision of a local judge, try and, you know, not ruin their whole lives because of an addiction or a health problem. She's also done a lot to combat child abuse at the court. She's a former juvenile court judge from Tippecanoe County, so she certainly knows that world as well.
And it's interesting to note, too, that that her picking up the honor for this year means that she's the second person who's gotten such an award here from Northwest Indiana, second year in a row, I guess, that we picked up these.
Yeah, that's right. Representative Ed Soliday from Valparaiso got the award last year for his work sponsoring the transportation, the road funding package that went through the General Assembly that was strongly supported by the Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. One final note here, too, Dan, of the stories that you carried, and you go into more detail, so it, you know, people have to take a look at it here, but you brought up an interesting point here about a community in central Indiana that's picked up a big honor, I guess, from Money Magazine, but what I thought was interesting was the reaction to folks up here in Northwest Indiana. We always complain about the fact that folks in central Indiana pick up all these honors. Why don't we get any of them up here in the region? And your story here talking about Carmel, Indiana, is one that bears that out.
Yeah, Carmel was just named the third best city in the entire country by Money Magazine. And the short answer for why no region city got it was because Money only looked at cities with 50,000 people or more.
Oh, that's okay. That explains everything, yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, to some extent, it's just, I mean, Hammond and Gary aren't competing with the Carmels of the world in terms of amenities and all sorts of things, but I also, as you pointed out, I also talked to a lot of some local mayors about, you know, what do they aspire to be the next Carmel? And what I found was interesting was a lot of them don't look at that as saying, okay, we need to try and be Carmel.
Yeah.
They say that they want to be the best city that they can be. So Mayor McDermott, Mayor Costas in Valparaiso, the St. John town manager, they all said that, you know, it's great what Carmel's doing. You know, Indiana certainly benefits from Carmel being this kind of super built-up destination city with a ton of amenities. But all of them sort of made the point that you need to be what your citizens want you to be. And Hammond is never going to be that kind of suburban community like Carmel. And, you know, Valparaiso has its own amenities. They have a college and Carmel doesn't. And, you know, they need to build around what their strengths are. St. John said, you know, they have the wealth similar to Carmel, but they also want to maintain that small town feel.
Well,
Carmel has almost 100,000 people. That's a different type of, you know, community than, say, St. John.
And it's tougher to get around to, especially if you're trying to go for, if you live in Carmel and you're trying to go to work in Indianapolis. And heaven forbid if you have to go into downtown Indianapolis, too. It takes an awful long time to be able to get there. And even though we have our traffic issues up here, you can still get around fairly easily compared to that, to be sure. So,
yeah, well, that's what's so interesting about Carmel is the way it's developed without any, like, direct connection to downtown Indianapolis.
Yeah, that's right.
And perhaps that's one reason it's been able to grow. It's its own thing that such a pain to get downtown that You might as well just stay home and shop or work.
Well, you have to drive around Indianapolis enough as it is just working at the State House to be sure we can understand why you'd have – you get to see that firsthand, you know, that maybe folks up here don't necessarily get to see. So,
yeah.
Dan Carton, State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. As always, Dan, thank you for bringing us your stories, and we hope to have you back on again soon.
Anytime.
Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio's Regionally Speaking, let's chat with Giles Bruce, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Giles, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Chris.
One of the big stories that you had on recently here is a very, very involved story about a heroin addict who overdosed, but luckily is alive and probably just barely, which is, I guess, something that we can say, which is a good story in a way. Tell us, if you will, more about when you're using the name Stephanie, by the way, as the person who had, I guess, become an addict and just about became a statistic. Tell us more about Stephanie and, I guess, how she got involved, unfortunately, in drug addiction in the first place.
Yeah, well, she, I first met her, found out about her when I reported on a heroin overdose save on a train in East Chicago, in the South Shore line. Turns out that, the story, obviously continued from there. I followed her story after that and heard about, like you said, how she got into drugs. And, she had actually started using them with her husband about a decade ago, had, some stressful life, upbringing, that kind of thing. And fell into drugs and, kept going from there. The addiction, she would get clean, get back on the drugs, get clean, back on the drugs. And, she was actually clean for a while recently until her doctor got in trouble with the, federal government for prescribing pills illegally.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, she lost the medication she was using and went back to heroin, and that's when she overdosed.
Tell us more about the incident that involved the South Shore. I guess that she had gotten on the train in Michigan City and was headed to Chicago. Then she, once you pick up more of her of the illegal drugs there, is that where she got her supply?
Yeah, she would. Take the train from, she lived in LaPorte, so she would take the train to Chicago purchase the heroin there and then use it on the way back. This was, something she had done before. And, this time she ended up overdosing in the bathroom and some passengers, noticed that the woman who went in the bathroom, 20 minutes earlier hadn't come out. So they tried knocking, got the train employees to knock, and they, didn't get a response. And then, they finally went in the bathroom, unlocked it, and found her unconscious. And then they stopped, and a South Shore Line police officer came on and gave her Narcan, which is the opioid overdose reversal drug that is used quite commonly across the nation and the region. I cited in the article that the number of naloxone saves in the U.S. increased by 75% from 2012 to 2016. 2017, Porter County emergency responders saved 47 people with naloxone. Lake County Police, in a recent one-year period, responded to more than 70 overdoses. So even though, the region has last year had a record number of drug overdose deaths, there could have been a lot more without this drug.
I understand in working on your story that ran into the Times here, you had a chance to talk with Jesse Watts Jr. He's the police chief, basically, for the South Shore Line transit officers. And he was the one, I guess, that was happened to be at the East Chicago station when he got the call. And I guess he was the one that, I guess, helped revive her by the naloxone.
He was, yeah. I had talked to him after when this incident first happened. And this had, it's becoming a somewhat common occurrence for him. He had saved two people previously, four altogether. One was after the Cubs World Series parade in November 2016. All of his department's officers carry naloxone, as do just about all, emergency responders nowadays. Even civilians can get naloxone from the pharmacy. So oftentimes, people who use heroin or their family members will have it on hand just in case an overdose happens, which is all, you know, very common today. As I quoted someone in the article, it's become a daily occurrence in the region, people overdosing on heroin, likely because of the spike in fentanyl, which you know, drug dealers either, you know, cut the heroin with, or they just sell it, you know, in place of the heroin because it's a lot cheaper, cheaper to get, and it's much more, much stronger, 50 to 100 times stronger than heroin.
Have you been able, since this time, to be able to follow up more and find out more how Stephanie is doing?
Yeah, I have been following her story over the last, basically since this happened 4 months ago, and you know, she reported that she, you know, this was a wake-up call for her, and she was trying to get into treatment, but she wasn't having luck in some cases. She was trying to find a doctor who prescribed Suboxone, which is a medication people use to get off of opioids, but she was not having luck because of insurance issues. She called a free, there was a free drug treatment program in LaPorte County, but they had run out of money. She was having other issues getting into rehab, but you know, finally, a few weeks ago, she got into a free women's drug treatment program in South Bend, where she is now, and she's been clean. When I was writing the article, she's coming up on 30 days, about a month clean and sober. So, hopefully that continues.
Well, sounds like, as we say, it's turned out to be a very good story instead of just being a statistic that would have shown up probably in the LaPorte County Coroner's report sometime or the other, to be sure. One of the other stories I know that you have worked on, Giles, that we'll talk more about here, and we've talked a little about this in the past, is the fact, that, of course, that LaPorte Hospital has changed owners, changed over from, I guess, from IU Health over to Community Health Systems not long ago, I guess about 2 years ago now, or it's just over 2 years now. But then now they are actually making plans to break ground, or they have broken ground, I guess, for a new facility. And you put that in a story as well, too. Tell us how we're doing with LaPorte Hospital and about the new hospital that's going up in that community.
Yeah, they hospital officials, community leaders broke ground on the new hospital last week. It's going to be at the site of the current hospital in downtown LaPorte there. Mm-hmm. It's going to be $125 million facility, expected to open in 2020, be 200,000 square feet. You know, have all the latest amenities, technologies. You know, the current hospital was, you know, getting up, you know, towards 40 years old. So this was part of the promise that the new owners made when they bought the hospital from IU Health in March 2016. They had promised to build a new hospital, which a lot of people thought was needed there, and you know, just to be a boost to the you know, healthcare. You know, situation there in LaPorte.
I noticed that you noted in your story too about how the hospital, since it's changed owners, in addition to the fact they agreed to build a new facility, that the current facility and the current system that's in there now is picked up quite a bit of I guess new business, I suppose, in a way. They've opened up some other facilities. Tell us about the changes since about the 18 months that they've owned the facility now.
As someone mentioned in the story, one of the people I quoted, in the last 18 months, the hospital there has recruited more than 20 new providers. They've opened new facilities, urgent care, primary care, pediatrics, including in Michigan City, new wound care center in LaPorte. Looking for future growth. They're going to have room in the new facility for future growth. And the new owner is investing $140 million overall. So, you know, they're going above and beyond just the hospital investment.
One of the other stories, too, Giles, that you had as well, talks about a rather, I guess, for some, a controversial business in the healthcare industry these days. We have a lot of people that take advantage of plasma donation centers, and there's a new one, I guess, that's opened up here in Northwest Indiana. Tell us about this facility and why it seems to be drawing so much fire sometimes.
The new facility that opened up this year was called CSL Plasma in Hobart. It's a place where people can go to donate their blood plasma, basically a yellow fluid that holds the blood cells together. Mm-hmm. It's used to create medications that treat people with hemophilia, compromised immune systems, burn victims, for to name a few. Essentially people can go in there. They can go twice a week, they get paid $70. They essentially sit there for an hour hooked up to a machine that is it looks like a dialysis machine. And their blood goes in, the plasma is removed, and then the rest of the blood is returned. Part of the controversy over it is, some critics say that these plasma centers are making a lot of money and they could pay people more, particularly since the centers are often located in poor communities, where people are, maybe more apt to use a center like this because they may be hard up for money. But for the people who donate, it is extra income for them at the same time, and it's also being used to make life-saving medications.
I understand that, I guess, there are certain, for anyone who maybe is familiar with the process or maybe not familiar with being a plasma donor, you have certain criteria that you would have to follow before you were even considered to be able to donate plasma.
Yeah. At this facility, for instance, you have to weigh at least 110 pounds, be an adult. They require that you have an address and a government-issued ID and live within a 55-mile radius. You can't be on drugs. They give you a drug screen. They give you kind of a basic physical to make sure you're in, good, essentially just good health. Make sure you're, you don't have any major health problems that would be affected by donating. Then they, they test the plasma itself, obviously, before using it for any number of diseases to make sure it's safe. As long as you meet those criteria, you can just, hop in there twice a week and donate.
Well, Giles, thanks for taking time to go over the stories that you had in the Times this recent days, and this last week in particular, with the move at the changes coming to LaPorte Hospital, and about the latest, I guess, to find out, too, on how Stephanie, the lady that you have made note of here, a woman who has been a heroin addict and hopefully staying clean now, have managed to have her life saved, not only by Narcan and the other methods, but also, too, by some quick work by some people who happened to found out about her overdosing on the train. Thanks a lot for being with us, and we'll have it back on again real soon, we hope. Thanks very much, Giles.
Yeah, thank you. Have a good day.
You're welcome. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. When word first came out about a confrontation at County Line Orchard between employees and a guest carrying a comfort dog, Regionally Speaking looked more closely at the distinction between a service animal and a comfort animal. We talked last fall with Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center in Chicago and with Valparaiso University School of Law Professor Rebecca Huss. First, here's Mr. Berg. If you will, define what a service animal is.
Sure. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, a service animal is defined as an individually trained dog that performs work or a task related to the person's disability.
And I guess you can actually, if you don't believe what you're hearing today, you can actually go on the ADA and look at what Title II and Title III is where the definitions are, I understand.
That is correct. The Department of Justice ADA homepage, ada.gov.
That's great. Can any animal be deemed as a service animal, according to the law?
When the Justice Department updated its, when you mentioned Title II, Title III regulations, those are the regulations. Title II applies to state and local governments. Title III applies to places of public accommodations or private businesses. When the Justice Department updated those regulations back in 2010, it limited the species of service animals to dogs only. So when it comes to different breeds of dogs, yes, any breed of dog, could be a service animal under the ADA.
I guess that's where some of the confusion comes in, I would imagine, because some people just basically establish in their minds, or they see more of them than others, that that a service animal is typically like a German Shepherd, not hardly a pit bull or some other type of a dog that you might consider that could possibly be one, right?
Sure. Anyway, a lot of it, I mean, when you go back and think, you know, 15, 25 years ago, when you said service dog or service animal, typically what people would think of is a guide dog that is assisting someone that is blind or has low vision. But over the past years, service animals have been trained to assist people with a wide range and variety of disabilities. So your typical thought of what a service animal is certainly different today than it was 25 years ago.
I guess then I could ask, can any animal be recognized as a service animal, or does it have to be just a dog?
Just a dog. Oh. The Department of Justice regulations limit service animals to dogs only. Okay. Now, there are other federal laws that recognize different types of animals, such as the Federal Fair Housing Act, but when it comes to the ADA, we're talking specifically about dogs.
And then we're going to have a conversation coming up here, talking with Valparaiso University School of Law professor Rebecca Huss, and she's going to talk about more about the housing aspect of the laws as well, too. Peter, I guess maybe it's time to talk about the difference between a service animal and what I know has been called a comfort animal, or maybe the official term, if there is one, is emotional support animal. What is the difference?
Sure. And there are different terms out there, emotional support animal, companion, therapeutic, comfort. And the ADA regulations and Department of Justice guidance specifically state that emotional support companion animals are not service animals as defined under the ADA. So what's the difference between a psychiatric trained service animal and a companion or emotional support animal? The difference is in what I like to refer to as R&R, and that's recognition and response. A trained service animal will recognize that something is happening with the handler, i.e., a service animal working with someone that has post-traumatic stress disorder will recognize that a loud sound, a noise, the crowd, something has triggered some type of episode with the person with a disability. Mm-hmm. That's the recognition. Then the response is that the service animal, the service dog, is trained to do something, nuzzle the person, get them away from whatever has triggered the episode, remind them to take medications and so forth. Versus an emotional support, and emotional support and companion animals are quite valuable to people with disabilities. They're just not service animals under the ADA. So with an emotional support animal, it's the actual presence of the animal that provides some type of benefit or relief or reduction in symptoms for the person with the disability. So the animal is not actively doing something. It's the presence that provides mm-hmm. that relief.
Where you might have someone, for example, that may have PTSD, and you mentioned earlier about loud noises or something that will trigger them and could set them off and get them into their problems. That's the job, I suppose, in the way of the dog to help comfort them in a way and get them out of the situation or whatever. But with an emotional support animal or a comfort animal, if somebody, say, has been known to have problems, they maybe have panic attacks, you know, things like that. This animal is with them to help make them deal with the real life, I suppose, that they're in a little easier, right?
Yeah, but again, to be a service animal and have the right, a person with a disability has the right to be accompanied by a service animal, mm-hmm. Wherever the general public is allowed to go within a business or facility or a government building. Okay. So when you talk about someone that may have anxiety, if the presence of the animal is what is benefiting the person, then that's not a service animal. If the animal recognizes that the person is having an anxiety attack, a panic attack, and then it does something, it grounds the person, it sits on the person's yeah. feet or presses up against them. There's an example of recognition and response.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Peter Berg, who is with Chicago-based Great Lakes ADA, about the issue of animals that are considered service animals and as distinguished between comfort or companion animals and the like. And you mentioned one of the points we would like to get into now about the legalities of things here. And of course, the ADA very specifically mentions all of this here, too. I guess the next question I have for you is, can a handler be asked for documentation of that service animal? And if they can, are there certain specific things that have to be mentioned before that handler can give whoever was asked the questions the answers.
Sure. The Department of Justice regulations and guidance is clear on this, that a business or state or local government entity may not require that someone show certification, proof of training, any type of registry. Mm-hmm. There are two questions that a business may ask, those questions being, one, is that a service animal that is needed because of a disability? If the person responds affirmatively, then the follow-up question a business may ask is, what work or task has the animal been trained to do?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I guess in this, obviously, it's important, with depending on whatever circumstances that you may happen to find yourself in, or the person may happen to find themselves in there, too. Can a handler or a dog be denied access to a public facility because the people that are in the public facility are afraid of the dog, or fear of any kind, I suppose, maybe I should say?
Yeah. Fear, allergies are not appropriate defenses for excluding a service animal.
Uh-huh.
There are certain instances where a service animal may be appropriately excluded, or where the person with a disability can be told to remove the animal, that being if the animal is out of control, it's barking, it's aggressive towards other people, and not just barking once because someone stepped on his tail, but you know, if it's out of control, the person doesn't take steps to get it under control, the business can ask that the animal be removed, or if the animal is not housebroken.
Now, since you get to work with cases like this all the time as part of your job there with Great Lakes ADA, are there any instances that you can recall that maybe is a case where somebody brought in an animal, a service animal in particular, we're talking here now, a dog, I guess, and had the problems of some kind, and the dog, the animal and the handler were asked to leave, and they followed through, didn't they? They just went ahead and left.
I've certainly, you know, been at Great Lakes for over 17 years and have had lots of inquiries into service animals, been lots of stories, you know, the stories that make the media, such as the one that you're exploring, instances where a service member, a veteran, has been denied access to a restaurant or a business, you know, when they're traveling with their service animal. It does still happen.
Mm-hmm. I know that the concern is that, you know, like you say, you would think that service dogs have been around for an awful long time, and you would think that people would be familiar with the dogs, but I'm sure there are probably just some settings that an average person may find it surprising for them. All of a sudden, this person comes in with a dog on leash, and we're not talking just the average little leash. We're talking a regular established leash that should automatically, and if they're not wearing some kind of vest or some other identification, that signifies that I am a service dog. I'm here for working purposes. Don't touch me.
Yeah. And thanks for bringing that. That's a good point. That the standards don't require, the ADA doesn't require that a service animal wear any type of identification. Mm-hmm. People can purchase that online. But to your point and to your question, I think what is important there is that people with non-obvious, non-visible disabilities use service animals, and I think that's where a lot of the part of the issue is that you have someone that's diabetic that uses a service animal that can detect low glucose levels, or someone that has a seizure condition, a service animal that's trained to detect, you know, an oncoming seizure, or we talked about the trained psychiatric service animals. Mm-hmm. So people, you know, it's like you know, someone pulling into the accessible parking space at the shopping center, and a person gets out, they're not using a wheelchair or cane or crutches, and someone thinks, well, that's not a person with a disability. Well, they very well could have, you know, a cardiac condition or respiratory condition.
Right.
So when people see someone walk into a business and they don't have an obvious disability, a lot of people automatically go, well, that's someone that's, that's their pet, or they're trying to, get one over on the business.
Well, we hear about people bringing dogs in purses and handbags and things like that. That's not, that may or may not be the case. That may be a comfort animal, but just the same, I guess that's what probably prompts people to kind of think twice about whether it's a service animal or not, I would think so.
Yeah, right. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, of course, we hear from businesses, you know, that think that people are trying to pull one over and bring their pet in with them. And yes, there is mm-hmm. abuse of that. If people know the two questions and they answer them appropriately, then, you know, they're going to be allowed to bring their pet in as a quote-unquote service animal. But, you know, the ADA, the service animal requirements, it's not unlike other laws. You know, there are speed limits out there on roadways that people, you know, don't follow, and people don't always pay their taxes. So this is just another example of where people, if they can get away with something, they will attempt to do so.
Now, Peter, if you will, tell us if your particular organization, Great Lakes ADA, or other similar organizations that are around here in the Midwest, do any kind of training sessions for business owners, for employees or staff members, and like to inform them as to what the rules are, how they're supposed to follow through if somebody comes in with a service animal.
Absolutely, and you would think that that we pre-planned this, but we just announced an upcoming training session that's going to be through our audio conference program that's taking place on November 21st between 1 and 2:30 p.m. Central Time. That session will be on service animals. People can get information about the session and actually register for the session by visiting ADA-audio.org. It's free to participate in that training. And then the Great Lakes ADA Center also does customized trainings. I've done trainings in the past as part of settlement agreements, for businesses that, ran afoul of the law. So
Right. We
provide information and we provide training on the ADA and service animal requirements.
Now, we're specifically, of course, dealing with the County Line Orchard incident here talking today, but I'm sure that you probably have come across other cases like this and probably come across the desk and we have discussions about this amongst your staff members where you have this question about service animals and comfort animals and the confusion is there and how do you deal with that? So I imagine this is not new, certainly.
No. And the key with many aspects of the ADA is education. In training, our business is training their frontline staff because it's not enough for the manager or the owner of a business to understand ADA requirements. It's the frontline staff that's going to have that first interaction with the public. And they need to know what the requirements are. I can say in general, businesses have done a fairly good job of training employees once the definition of service animals changed back in 2010. Through my experience in talking with people on the telephone, I have noticed that some people will identify their animal as an emotional support or a companion animal. But then as I talk further with them, they begin to describe work and tasks that the animal actually performs for them. So in fact, it is a service animal, but they identify it incorrectly as a companion or support animal.
Well, Peter, thank you very much for spending time with us today to talk about this topic here. And I'm sure it'll come up again in some other conversations. And if so, we'll hopefully get back with you to talk more about it here. We've been talking with Peter Berg. He is with Chicago-based Great Lakes ADA, which, of course, stands for the Americans with Disabilities Act, about the rules and the regulations about having service animals and how we can try to differentiate them between the device, I guess, that's out there called a comfort animal or an animal that might be able to help for emotional support for somebody. Peter, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Let's continue our conversation talking about the differences between service animals and comfort animals here. Now, let's take it from another voice in the conversation. Rebecca Huss is a professor of law. She is the Phyllis and Richard Duesenberg Chair in Law at the School of Law at Valparaiso University, and she joins us from her office over on campus. Professor Huss, thank you very much for being with us today.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these important issues.
We've been in our conversation here with Mr. Berg about the ADA issues. We brought up here in our conversation before we started talking here, before we went on the air, to talk about the fact that there are more laws involved that deal with service animals and what people can have as service animals, as well as, I guess, this question of comfort animals, which is a much newer concept, I understand, than the typical guide dogs and things like that that people expect to see. People that are blind and have other physical disabilities have a dog to lead them through life, basically, especially when they're out in public. Where do all of these things fit in here with the research that you've done? Because animal law is one of the classes that you teach there at Valparaiso.
Right. Well, one of the things I focus on is the actual confusion that people have over what is covered. And under the ADA, it's a pretty narrow definition of service animal. An animal has to be a dog, and there's some special rules relating to miniature horses, but we don't see very many cases about that. But generally, the service animal has to be a dog that's individually trained to do work or perform tasks. So you mentioned the idea of a comfort animal. When the regulations were revised and became effective in 2011, it became very clear in those regulations that an animal that merely provides emotional support would not be covered under the ADA.
And we talk about, when we mentioned about the specifics here, and we cover some of these things, of course, also in our other conversations about what the law says. We look at the typical dogs and typical cats and the like here. What does the law specifically say about service animals now?
Well, service animals can do a variety of tasks, and I think this is where there can be some confusion. Essentially, service animals can do tasks relating to seizure alert or even tasks relating to psychological or psychiatric disorders that might not be apparent to someone who might be interacting with the person with a disability. So, for example, a service animal might be trained to do the task of nudging a person to bring them back to the time and place where they're at. Mm-hmm. And so those are somewhat subtle actions that we're not necessarily used to seeing in a public sphere.
When you look into this in more detail, you talk about the legal aspects here. We probably also, I guess, should mention as well, too, that there are a lot of other issues that come up besides just access to property, access to public facilities and the like, and what the ADA covers in that respect from the Americans with Disabilities Act. You mentioned, too, about the fact that there's some housing laws that play into this, too. And I think maybe people don't realize that. You think about the Fair Housing Act. You think about that specifically about having access to the type of housing that people should have or can have. But that also includes these types of animals, too. How does all that fit into this?
Well, that's an excellent question, because the definition under the Fair Housing Act is assistance animals. Mm-hmm. And assistance animals actually is a broader definition than what we see for the Americans with Disabilities Act for service animals. Specifically, assistance animals, which are protected, so a person who needs to have an assistance animal with them in housing, and the definition of housing is actually very broad too, can be a service animal that we think of as a traditional service animal, an individually trained animal that is trained to do work or perform tasks, but also the assistance animal definition includes emotional support animals. And because of that, you can have an animal that's not individually trained, and the guidance that the government has provided to us illustrates that you absolutely don't need to have an animal that's individually trained that still would fit within that definition of assistance animal. Mm-hmm. The other really important difference between the definition of assistance animal under the FHA, or the Fair Housing Act, and what we see under the ADA is there's not a species restriction. So that's how you can have a cat that can be acting as an emotional support animal. So, one final thing that's important to remember about the Fair Housing Act, though, you have to still show, and the requirements for providing the information to the housing provider are broader than what is required for public accommodations, a restaurant, or out in an ADA situation.
Right.
You have to show a connection or a nexus between the disability and the need for the assistance animal. So you still have to show that you are an individual who is covered by the act, you have a disability, and the animal is necessary for you to enjoy the housing.
So I guess if you come to a point, for example, if you go to a landlord or you go to a manager at an apartment complex and you'd like to find a place to live, and you have a comfort animal, we'll say a cat, maybe because perhaps you suffer from some kind of trauma, or maybe you have anxiety attacks or something like that, and this animal helps you cope with life, you have to at least show some doctor's information,
yeah,
whatever.
You have to have some documentation. Yeah. And there's restrictions on how deep a dig the housing provider can ask for documentation, but you do need to have credible documentation that you have a need for this animal. Now, there's been certainly case law that indicate that if somebody clearly has a disability and there's a easily shown need for an assistance animal, then a housing provider should not be asking for documentation. But certainly for people who don't have an apparent disability, it's very common for housing providers to ask for documentation that can be things like a doctor's letter to indicate that the animal is necessary to assist the person with a disability.
What's brought us to our attention and has gotten our curiosity going on this topic has been the incidents that happened recently at the County Line Orchard involving a woman and apparently her comfort animal, or what's been determined to be a comfort animal, not a service animal, and people that work at the facility. And we're not getting into the individual case of this because we don't have anything that we can really talk about right now about this, but it's such an interesting topic. When you have a situation like that, and maybe you know of some other cases in case law that bring this up in other situations, not here in Indiana necessarily, but we find that it's very difficult for people that can show that they have the need for comfort animals, is what you say, and you have to have the documentation when it comes to housing and the like. Do you have to have that sort of documentation if you happen to bring the animal out in public and you try and bring the animal in with you into some place?
Well, there's a couple things that relate to the recent incident. First of all, not even people who have disabilities always use the, quote, magic words that we see in the Americans with Disabilities Act. So as long as an animal is individually trained to do work, perform tasks, That's the key to whether the animal should be accommodated in a public accommodation, for example, in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So it's unclear whether the dog was really a quote, comfort animal or a dog individually trained to do work or perform tasks. And that's something that we'll have to see going forward.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue about that particular incident is that from some of the coverage that I saw, one of the reasons why there was some concern about the animal was because of the breed of the animal. And in the recent regulation revision, the Department of Justice made it very clear that it's not acceptable to exclude a service animal based merely on breed. Specifically, the Department of Justice has said, and there's case law that backs this up now, that an accommodation, a public accommodation, a restaurant, et cetera, can't exclude a service animal based on breed, period.
Yeah.
If an animal is out of control, that animal can be excluded, but you can't do it based solely on the appearance of the dog. So that's something that can cause confusion because it is different than what we've seen historically. But we do have guidance on that from the Department of Justice. So I think my point is that even people who might be partnered with service animals and might have the ability to access might not be using the language that the businesses are used to hearing. And businesses are not necessarily used to seeing animals that aren't traditionally used as service animals.
Right. Now, do you think this, not necessarily this particular incident, but others that may have happened elsewhere or might happen in the future might prompt more discussion, maybe some changes in the law when it comes to dealing with the distinction between service animals and comfort animals to try and clear all this confusion up?
So that's a great question. I don't anticipate we're going to have a wholesale scale change in the regulations because we did just have this process not very many years ago. One area that we are seeing some potential rulemaking in is on airplanes. There's a different law called the Air Carrier Access Act, referred to as the Air Carrier Access Act, that the Department of Transportation runs that has an even more complicated system for determining what animals can be brought on the plane by persons with disabilities. So there actually was a rulemaking process that started last year that it was a negotiated rulemaking process, which is basically a process where you try to get a lot of constituencies together to make a decision about what a proposed rule should be.
Mm-hmm.
It failed from the perspective of the service animal definition because the constituencies could not agree. And so I anticipate we probably will see some rulemaking there. That, again, is a more complicated process. So for persons that don't understand why somebody can have a cat on a plane, that definition is different, and the process for determining whether you're allowed to have your cat on the plane as an accommodation for someone who's disabled is a different set of rules.
Rebecca Huss, she is a professor of law at Valparaiso University. And before Rebecca, we heard Peter Berg with the Great Lakes ADA Center, which, by the way, you can find out more about the topic on their website. That conversation, by the way, was from October of 2017. That's all for Regionally Speaking here today and this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Hope you'll be back with us on Monday.